10:06.
I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. A generation ago, the only screen a parent had to monitor for their children was the TV screen. I'm a baby boomer. My family was late to buying a TV, and I could watch just one show a week. Today, most families have several TVs, a library of DVDs, a video game system, tablets, and cell phones. In other words, lots and lots of screens. Many parents want to limit their kids' screen time, but it's not easy when they're so accessible and so appealing. Dwight Garner talked about the struggles he and his wife have managing what their kids watch in a New York Times review he wrote of three books with advice and warnings about too much media. He's book critic for The Times, former senior editor of the New York Review of Books, and joins us this morning on Radio Times by telephone. And Dwight Garner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Amy Blakely, and she's a senior research scientist in health communication at the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And Amy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Dwight, I have to say, I really loved your book review, and I don't often say that, but I'd just like to begin reading really the first sentence here. My house may be like your house. As I type these words, my daughter Harriet, who is 14, is on her iPhone, skipping among no fewer than 8 social media sites: Flickr, Tumblr, Kick, Snapchat, Instagram, Ask FM, Twitter, and Vine, rarely Facebook. Facebook, she says, is so 2011. So you think your house is like a lot of other people's houses in this country?
I suspect so. I mean, you know, children just have access to computers and iPhones and tablets, and, you know, the allure of them is really strong, and my children love them, and I am certain that if I were their age, again, I would love them as much as they do. My problem, which I explain in the piece, is that I feel like I've kind of lost my kids a bit. Their default setting now is to disappear into their rooms with my daughter on her iPhone talking to her friends via social media sites and my son playing video games.
And feeling that you're not with them, or they're living in a world that you can't access?
Well, both. I mean, there are different situations in a way. My daughter, I feel slightly better about in the sense that she's really conversing with her friends on these social media sites. I mean, there are perils to these sites, things I worry about. I mean, I call it sort of, at least in my house, I call it sort of selfie culture, in the sense that selfies are pictures you take with your own phone of yourself. And a lot of these social media sites are these girls, my daughter and her friends, and they're all lovely kids. I love them. But they're on these sites sending each other pictures of themselves and talking about, you know, music and boys. And you know, to some degree, it's social and it's interesting. But, you know, my daughter has her thumbs on her iPhone 24 hours a day, and I worry about that. My son is very different, quickly, just that he plays video games, these immersive experiences, and he'll play them all night and all day and all night and all day if someone doesn't walk into his room and say, hey, you have to go outside and see the sun once today.
Well, in fact, you describe him playing Call of Duty and Eve all night long, not just doing that, but also eating junk food all night long as well.
Yeah. Nacho cheese Doritos, jelly beans, Code Red Mountain Dew, and Kit Kat candy bars.
Right. All the food groups.
Menu from hell, yeah.
Right, all the food groups. So, Amy, is Dwight Garner's family sound like a lot of families in this country?
I think so, yes. That's about what we see when we look at households and all the screens and access. But what we found in our latest research is that it's what parents are doing also that influence what their kids are doing.
Help us understand that. So, I mean, I guess we shouldn't be surprised that children are watching their parents and perhaps parents setting the ground rules either intentionally or unintentionally.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be a few things. I think it could be parents modeling the behavior. I mean, just like Dwight was saying, kids have access to all these things. So we thought access was a really big predictor of how much time kids were going to spend with TV. But then we found that it's really parents' time as well. What the parents are doing how they choose to spend their time in the house and different media practices in the home. It's sort of like the home culture, like what sets the tone.
And people are still watching TV. I mean, with all these other screens and all these other ways of connecting with people and watching things, they're still watching TV?
Yes, surprisingly, television still dominates kids' media times. Even though they do play a lot of video games and are online and social networking, television does make up the majority of the time that they spend with media right now.
Is that true for you, Dwight, in your house?
Interestingly, it's not. It's funny, and I'm a little bit sorry about that, because I was looking forward to the day when my kids were old enough to sort of, after dinner, come sit with my wife and myself and watch a good movie or watch, you know, one of those great new TV shows, The Sopranos or Orange is the New Black. And our kids are finally old enough to watch these sort of adult series, which were so great, and now they don't want to. They would rather be in their rooms on their computers. And, you know, they watch some TV, but no, in my house, they would much rather be on their own devices, as it were.
But, I mean, it sounds like, they are interacting with their friends, mm-hmm. or with someone somewhere else is playing, let's say, a video game with them?
Sometimes. My son has a friend online, a local friend, a physical, real-world friend who he plays these games with quite often. But he also has friends in the online world, people he has never met, who he is on Skype with as they play the games. And so I'll hear him in his room talking to another boy, a boy he has never met and we've never met. And, of course, you know, for a while my wife and I were very concerned about this. You know, who is he speaking to? Who are these people? Is this some kind of grown man, some kind of, you know, person. But it turns out they are other kids. And one of the interesting comments on the piece that I wrote for the Times was a young man who wrote that these kind of people he played games with online were important to him as a young person. He felt that they were social, they were people he interacted with, and he was lonely, and these online games and talking to other kids was kind of a big deal for him when he was young.
Well, and does that make some sense to you, Amy? I mean, the idea that there's so many different ways now to have a friendship or a relationship.
Oh, definitely. I mean, kids are still socializing with one another, just using media as a mediator for doing that. So they'll talk to each other through their Facebook pages, or maybe not Facebook if it's so a few years ago.
Exactly.
So 2011. But,
through their social networking, through the video games. I think with boys especially who are really into video games, having that online community is really important, or does become important in their lives.
I also think this notion of multitasking, I think Dwight sort of references that. The idea is that,
yes,
is that sort of navigating between all these various screens that are beeping and you know, making noises to get our attention.
Yes, it comes naturally to them in a way. And even when they're doing non-media activities like homework or anything else, media is somewhere in the background, most likely.
And Dwight, you also wrote about how you and your wife, especially with the school year about to start, you know, set some ground rules, and then within a week's time, the ground rules have completely been discombobulated. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, it's such a slippery slope. I mean, this is the time of year every year where my wife and I, you know, type up a list of rules and put them in the kids' rooms. You know, you must not sleep with your computer. We must have your door open when you have your computer. No computers between this time and this time. And inevitably, within a week or so, these rules begin to fracture. And it's hard to keep things straight. I mean, you'll say no computer screens, and your kid will come in and say, well, I'm doing my homework. I need to look up this, this, and this. And right. So, okay, take your computer. You come back, and they're on Facebook or playing a video game or doing something else. And, you know, I know from my own, just before I came on this morning, I was writing an article in my office. And, you know, at the same time I was writing, my Twitter feed was open, and I was getting email, and I was doing, you know, we're all multitasking. And, you know, we give our kids their computers, do their homework. We find they're doing other things on them, and it's maddening. And yet, that's the way we're all living these days. Right. So it's just complicated.
Does that make sense to you, Amy?
It does. This is the
world we're all living in.
It's true. And I think when it comes to rules, we've found when it's related to television, at least, that they don't really work, except for kids between, you know, 6 and 11 years old. I think with adolescents, it's much more trickier, and parents have a harder time enforcing those rules. And, you know, adolescence is a time when they want to be independent and parents feel like they have less control. And so things get a little murkier during that age.
But yeah, also the idea of sort of one size fits all. Because I would think for some
right.
kids, having a friend and an online friend might be a really good thing for them. They might be really shy and in the analog world, but online they have a whole community of people.
Yeah, I think it's definitely about the individual kid. I mean, like we talk about sometimes watching television or spending time with media isn't necessarily bad and could be fine if your kid has lots of other friends or engages in a lot of other activities. But it's when these things are excessive and you really start to worry about maybe the time they spend and it starts to affect other things in their lives is when the red flags start to go up.
And Dwight, do you feel like with your children it becomes excessive or it is excessive?
Yeah, it does. You know, this all really came about because, my son in particular, his grades, he's a smart kid, and his grades just were not even close to what they should have been this past school year. And and we blame part of that on his video game use. He would rather be doing that than anything else.
Right.
And he stays up too late at night on the computer, and then he's tired in the morning, and he's not ready for school. And, you know, his grades just suffered. And I'm sure there are many reasons why. And, you know, he's resolved to to do better and to be on his video games less. But we've noticed the change, and not just things like grade suffering, but, you know, as I wrote in the piece, I feel like my kids are paler than they should be. I feel like they're ill at ease with casual boredom. I feel like they don't read enough. I feel like they've missed out on some experiences they might have had were they not in their rooms on their computers. Just being outside, we live on a river in the town where we live in New Jersey, and, you know, just swinging from a rope. Just the sense of them in this hermetic environment on their screens all the time just worries me.
You even write about them being quote-unquote left to their own devices.
Exactly.
Right?
and yet, I'll add that I was that kind of kid who watched a lot of television as a kid. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I don't want to be the kind of parents who shut our... We want our kids to grow up in the generation they grow up in. We don't want to, you know, go the full Amish, as someone said, and unplug them. We want them to be comfortable in the wired world. It's just trying to find a balance.
Well, and I wonder how much you even want to be the, you know, the video game police, whether you want that kind of relationship with your son.
I don't. And, you know, it's funny. I, as I wrote in the article, I feel like I bear a good deal of the blame for all this, because on some level for parents, computers are a godsend in the way that TV can be for someone with a young child. You know, the kids are self-entertaining units on their computers. You know, they're not in our hair. They're not being asked to be driven anywhere. You know, we are free to live our lives when our kids are in the room on their computers. And so it's a babysitter to some degree. We feel like we're the ones who have to step up and, you know, take control a little bit more.
Well, your research, Amy, and others really says that children do model their parents, and what their parents do does have an influence on what their kids do.
Yes, that's what we've been finding. So if the parents are watching TV in their free time or on the computer or always looking at their phone, the kids are going to get used to that, and they're going to see that, and they're going to learn that that's how they can behave and use media.
I think we've all seen, you know, parents at the park on their cell phones while their kids play. I mean, is that a bad thing? I don't know. You know, I don't know. They could be talking to their friend and ignoring them rather than talking to their friend on the phone.
Yeah, I mean, we can't. It's really hard. And like Dwight was saying, I think something that's really common we hear from parents all the time is media is used as a babysitter a lot. It just gives parents a little bit of free time to cook dinner, check their email, just take a breath. And it's a challenge to find that balance, to not leave them for a few hours in front of the screen, but
to know that it's there.
Right.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about managing screen time in this hour of Radio Times. And we want to hear from you about how you do that with your children, young or old, or perhaps even do with the people in your life. Do give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We know a lot of people are struggling with this issue. Amy Blakely is a senior research scientist in health communication at the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Dwight Garner is a book critic for the New York Times, former senior editor of the New York Times Review of Books, and had a really great review earlier this week. He reviewed three books about warning and advice about too much media, and his review was sounded like better than the books he was reviewing. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Studio Incaminati, School for Contemporary Realist Art in Center City, supports WHYY and announces its weekly continuing education classes. Students can develop their artistic skills and learn new ones in small classes taught by instructors who are working professional artists. Drawing and painting classes for all skill levels focus on the portrait and figure, and there are special classes for high school students. Semester begins September 16th. Details at studioincaminati.org. The WHYY Connections Festival is back with a day of free live music featuring They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. The WHYY Connections Festival is free for everyone, and WHYY members and sustainers get exclusive access to the member Oasis tent all day long. They Might Be Giants and more Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza. For a full lineup and to register, visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, for the devoted fans, it's a much-anticipated rock reunion. This weekend, The Replacements will play their first show in more than 20 years. Rock you tomorrow. Tonight, I can't hold. next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Dwight Garner and Amy Blakely about screen time, managing screen time. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What happens in your house? Give us a call. 1-888-477-WHYY. Amy, let me go back to you and even go back to the really little ones, you know, the 1 and 2 year olds. And the American Academy of Pediatrics and others have said it's really important to limit screen time when kids are so little. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes. So they recommend that kids younger than 2 not have any screen time at all, which sometimes is more feasible than others. A lot of daycare settings use screens to occupy the kids. And then children over than 2, they recommend no more than 2 hours a day of non-entertainment. Of non-educational media. So no more than 2 hours a day of entertainment screen time, basically.
So whether it's TV, whether it's an iPad or tablet or whatever screen related.
Yes, unless it's educational, right. So clearly most kids, I think in our recent survey, only about a third of kids were in that group of 2 hours a day of screen time.
I know of one-year-olds that, you know, will see a smartphone. And
sure.
And they're just, you know, they reach for it. I mean, there's this delicious looking screen and they reach for it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my daughter, who is now almost 3, when she was younger, you know, she sees us with our iPhones and then we'd go to the grocery store and in the checkout aisle, she'd try and swipe the screen that where all the prices come up, thinking that's what you do when you see a screen. You just swipe at it. So they learn.
Yeah, they do learn. And Dwight, I wonder when your kids are teenagers now, but when they were little, just how much control did you have when they were little over their screen time?
Well, luckily for us, you know, iPhones weren't around when my kids were little. You know, tablets weren't around. We, you know, my wife and I had, you know, desktop computers, and those were easier to control for kids. You know, they tended to be in our offices, and you know, our kids didn't have their own, and so things were just easier back then.
How about when you were little?
When I was little.
Yeah, when you were little, Dwight.
I watched a lot of television, and I loved it, you know. And it worked out for me in the sense that I still read a lot. And so I feel like my immersion in bad American sitcoms, you know, we're talking about the Brady Bunch and Gilligan's Island and all MASH and all these things that I spent my childhood wasting my hours, you know, I don't feel like it harmed me in any way. Necessarily. And so that's part of why, you know, we want our kids, as I said earlier, to grow up in the generation they're in. We want them to be conversant with the online world and comfortable in it. We just find that there's a line that just gets rolled over so easily, and it's a hard line to draw.
But do you, I mean, your kids are teenagers, and it gets a little bit more complicated, but are there times you throw your kids out essentially saying, you know, go play in that river in our backyard?
Yes, all the time. We toss them out, and we take their computers away and hide them. Sometimes we come home and find them, you know, scouring the house as if they're looking for buried treasure. Inevitably, though, things just return to the way they were before after a certain amount of time. And, you know, the hard thing is keeping yourself to these rules and also trying to figure out what you really want the rules to be.
Yeah. Well, as you say, I mean, you say in this piece, my kids are smart, they're kind, they're more or less well-adjusted. And as you said, you watch a lot of TV growing up. And, you know, for a while, you were the senior editor of the New York Review of Books. That's a pretty...
New York Times Book Review.
Oh, New York Times Book Review. But still, a pretty heady job.
Right. Well, I loved to read when I was a kid. And I one phrase I used in my piece about my kids not being comfortable with quote, casual boredom. And, you know, that's what childhood is or what childhood summers were like for me anyway, being bored a lot and looking for ways to relieve that boredom. And one of the ways for me was to read books. And, you know, my kids read to some degree, but they don't read anywhere near the way I read at that age. And one of the reasons is that there are other more delightful things to spend their time on, meaning these devices.
Well, even going back to you, Amy, I mean, we're talking about this as if it's bad for kids. I mean, do we know that excessive or a lot of screen time does stunt development, emotional development, other kinds of development?
There are studies that have causally linked excessive screen time to problems like obesity and poor academic achievement, poor sleep issues, too. So we do know that there are some adverse outcomes associated with screen time. But, you know, it's not all bad.
Yeah.
Media can, you know, be really powerful and promising. There's a lot of great content, great games, you know, that can help with development and that kids can learn a lot about the world around them and how to interact with peers.
Because oftentimes TV can be very passive, but a lot of these video games and other forms, as Dwight was describing his daughter, you know, on all these various social sites, are very interactive. I mean, they're very active, really.
Yeah, that's true. They're learning how to socialize, I think, through computers now, which is something that's new and might be out of the comfort zone for parents of teenagers.
My son, when he meets another kid who plays video games, or even an adult who plays or knows about computers, is not very conversant with the world of coding and different kinds of games and types of endings and types of characters. And I feel like increasingly the kind of jobs our kids will have will be, you know, working to some degree with computers and in the online universe increasingly. And that kind of being conversant with those things I find interesting and you know, probably helpful to some degree in the long run.
I have to. My kid is older than both of yours, and I have been at Thanksgivings, and he and his cousins, and I have to include the parents myself as well. Sometimes sitting around the living room, everyone's on a laptop or you know some kind of a phone device. I mean, we're conversing, but we're all connected to this digital world.
You're
I'm
together.
Looking. Yeah, we're sort of together and not together at the same time.
Yeah, together alone is the great phrase someone used. Or alone together.
Alone together. Yeah, exactly. Guilty as charged. Well, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're talking about managing screen time, and there are many screens in all of our lives, talking with Amy Blakely from the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School, and also with Dwight Garner, who writes reviews for the New York Times, was the editor of the New York Times book review as well. Let me see what Cher from Flemington, New Jersey has to say. Cher, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay. Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a speech therapist. I work with kids in an elementary setting, and the majority of my students are disabled and primarily have autism. And we all know kids with autism or kids on the spectrum really struggle with affiliating themselves with others. That's their primary area of deficit is, you know, social interaction. So it intrigues me, and I have to say it disturbs me that I work with students in order to break that tendency towards isolating themselves and push them and give them the skills to affiliate real time in any situation with others. And what you're describing is basically a move as we let technology lead us, which basically it is leading us. We don't know what the outcome will be. We're kind of riding along on top of it. You're describing this purposeful move away from a real affiliation with other people to a very contrived unidimensional affiliation with other people. So that's just my take on it.
Well, that's interesting, Cher, and it's interesting you call it unidimensional. I don't quite see it that way, but let me see what Amy says and Dwight as well.
I think that's an interesting point. What we're starting to look at now and what we're trying to find out is it's not necessarily the case that using technology and computers to socialize is replacing face-to-face interaction. It might actually even be strengthening offline relationships that they have, and which would be great. So we're trying to tease that out now. Yeah. So it's not necessarily replacing it, even though it might seem the case if they're locked in their rooms with their computers on Facebook. But they could be talking with their friends from school and really forming more closeness and, you know, different aspect to their friendship.
Yeah, what do you think, Dwight?
Well, to take my kids as an example, they're very different experiences. My daughter has four or five great close friends, and for her, being on her iPhone when she's away from her friends is a way of being in touch with them 24 hours a day. All these girls do is text hundreds of times a day, send pictures of each other on all these social media sites. So, you know, my daughter is just completely convivial. I mean, she's just as social as can be and talking to her friends all day long. What bothers me with her is that she's not often with us anymore. Even right. when she's with us, she's, you know, looking for something to take a picture of and send to her friends. So, you know, in a way, it's for her, it's a quite social experience. For my son, it's very different, and it could just be different personality types. But like many boys, he's less interested in social media, more interested in video games. And I feel like for him, it's a little bit more closed off in the way your caller described. I worry more about his experience because it's more solitary.
Mm. But I'm curious, do you use social media at all? Maybe you even use that old-fashioned thing called Facebook. I mean, do you have friends that you converse with online?
Not so much converse with, but I'm a Twitter addict. I love Twitter, and by following people on Twitter, I feel like I'm in this constant conversation with 1,000 people I find the most intelligent and witty, you know, in the world, really. I mean, all the people I follow on Twitter are just smart and have interesting things to say all day long, and so I love being in the Twitter world, and I'm constantly checking in and out of it, and I comment there myself. It's less conversations that go on there. It's more, you know, did you see this great article, or here's this observation I have about the culture. But yeah, I am kind of an addict. And I look at Facebook, I like to keep up with people in my family, and that's where, you know, for Facebook I go for sort of family news. For Twitter I go for, you know, interesting remarks.
Cher, thanks for the call. Let me see what Valerie from Deptford has to say. Valerie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to say how interesting I'm finding your discussion.
Excellent.
And just picking up on the word addict, I do want to add that I did experience with my own sons how addicted they became to their video games as young teens, and I am aware that there is a connection between and video games and the brain and the rush that these games give in the brain, similar to the rush from opiate use. And I'm just kind of throwing into the discussion kind of a more dark aspect that overexposure may predicate a young brain to serious addiction.
Well, Valerie, I'm looking at you, Amy, only because you're our resident researcher for this hour. Is there any truth to what Valerie says about addiction? I mean, actual addiction?
I think it does exist. It's not as common as you might think. But yeah, there are problems with addiction. And there's a lot of research now coming out about adolescent brains and how they're not fully developed until later on in life. And you know, researchers trying to tease out what's going on exactly there and how media is affecting that development. So it's definitely an issue. It's not by any means most an issue that most kids have. But
when we think of real addiction,
right, when we think of strictly, you know, defined addiction.
Well, I must say, I mean, there is something kind of Skinnerian if you have your phone is sort of beeping in your purse or your pocket, there is this impulse to answer it.
I mean, there's a dependency,
to see
right,
what's there.
Yeah.
To see what's there. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that too sometimes, Dwight?
Oh, I do. I mean, you know, there's that feeling when I'm off my devices for a long time. It's like the feeling when you've had a long day and you finally get to cocktail hour and you have that first sip of your glass of wine or your martini and you just feel like, wow, like this just feels great. I'm where I want to be. And, you know, I find that if I've been at the beach all day and haven't checked in my email or Twitter, I'll go home and have that same kind of rush when I open my laptop and check my email and my texts and my Twitter feed. It's this great sense of this rush of sort of relaxation and pleasure that I get. And I it'd be wrong for me to deny that pleasure.
Well, I mean, it is a kind of positive reinforcement, right? I mean, there's stuff there for you to look at or to interact with or deal with.
Oh, exactly. And most days I feel like, you know, the rat hitting the cocaine bar in the cage getting more and more.
The pigeon
so
getting the...
I'm trying to police myself. I really am.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting, I mean, as I said, I think you were more interesting than the books that you were reviewing in the Times, but it seemed like you were not particularly impressed with these particular books who were giving advice, the authors were giving advice about how to manage media.
Right. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of self-help books, mostly because, you know, I love reading for the pleasure of good sentences. I mean, that's just what I'm about as a reader and saying smart things. And for the most part, self-help books are not that well written, but that's not necessarily what they're trying to be. I mean, they're trying to give advice. But I found that these books were interesting but extremely padded. I mean, the information could have been written in all three cases in a magazine article. That's just my problem with these books. But having said that, there were interesting things in all three of them.
Yeah. I mean, I've always believed that no one really ever takes advice. I mean, we give it all the time and no one
ever. Good for other people.
Yeah, exactly. It's good for that one person over there. I'm interested in the kind of research that you do, Amy, and how you look at and find out about how people negotiate, manage their media.
Is it
good old-fashioned research?
Yeah, we do surveys a lot. We talk to parents, too. I mean, it depends on the questions we're asking and what we want to know. But the data we collected from our most recent study that came out was a large survey, a national survey. And that's what
and
we
this
do.
Was, and this was looking at parents, sort of parents viewing
habits? Yeah, we interviewed or surveyed about over 1,550 parents of all ages, with kids of all ages, and asked them about their own behavior, their kids' behavior, and then we talked to the adolescents of those parents too. So we're able to compare what the parents say and the adolescents say and figure out more about the dynamic and how that contributes to their media use.
And is it do as I say but not as I do? I
mean, something like that.
So the parents said, well, this is what I do, or this is the way we live, and the kids are saying not so fast?
Yeah. I mean, parents are underestimating the amount of time their adolescents spend with media, and we have to figure out if they think their behavior affects their kids.
Yeah. Yeah, what has been the response to your book review?
My kids are a bit put out by it.
I was wondering about that.
But they're okay. I mean, you know, they realize that having a father who writes for 2 million people on a regular basis. I mean, they've been mentioned a lot in my pieces, and most of the mentions have been quite glowing and positive. So I've told them it's all going to even out in the end. but I've been hearing from a lot of parents, and a lot of them, even colleagues at the New York Times, have been writing me like 7 or 8 of them just to
really?
Say. You know, thank you for this. I mean, if for nothing else than acknowledging the feelings that I have and the worries that I have and the same problems. I think it's a pretty common problem.
But, I mean, it sounds like what you want to watch TV with. I mean, if we're talking screen time, what you would like, Dwight, is to watch TV with your kids?
Well, it's funny, I mean, compared to being online, watching a movie with your family feels like a real group experience now. at one point, I don't think it did. It felt like, alone together. But now, sitting around with my kids watching a movie or TV feels like a real, family outing in a way, which is probably a poor commentary. But I do love watching movies and things with my kids. I like showing them, what good film is, and I enjoy that. Online experience, I feel like I have no control over whatsoever.
Right. And we're almost about a break here, Amy, but Dwight's kids, they're teenagers, and it seems that, I mean, that's a fraught time in many ways anyway. I mean, children often want to be as far away from their parents as they can get.
Yeah, I think peers take on a dominant role in adolescence, and parents sort of fall to the wayside a little bit. So, unfortunately, Dwight's experience is pretty common. But I think it's interesting. I mean, we talk about, you watching movies with your kids. Co-viewing is what we call it. And it's often recommended for parents of younger kids to help sort of mitigate the content of what they're seeing. So parents can be there to explain things that might be a little bit above their age. But it does contribute to that increased time. So if you are concerned with how much time your kids spend, co-viewing with your parents just seems to add more time, not replace kids' own time.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Amy Blakely and Dwight Garner about screen time and kids and parents, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What do you do in your house? Give us a call, 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be right back.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Lewis Black didn't start performing comedy until he was in his mid-30s. He got into it after he'd given up on theater.
I'd chosen a career in which your highest hopes was to end up in a theater somewhere, which was like being a abusive orphanage.
Lovable curmudgeon, Lewis Black, on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Elmore Leonard, the crime novelist and screenwriter behind Get Shorty, Out of Sight, and Fire in the Hole, which was adapted into the FX series Justified. We'll also listen back to an interview with jazz pianist Marion McPartland. She died Tuesday at 95. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
A new activism meets a moment of change in the Voting Rights Act.
What we know about our opposition is that they don't go away. They just change. They're like a virus. They mutate. And we had to change with them.
Marvin Randolph from the NAACP on how activists are responding to the aftermath of this year's Supreme Court decision. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about living with and managing all the screens in our lives, whether it's TVs or DVDs, video game systems, tablets, cell phones. Talking with Dwight Garner, book critic for the New York Times, and also Amy Blakely, senior research scientist in health communication at the Annenberg Public Policy Center here in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Clara from Lawrenceville to join us. Clara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
This is maybe a sort of a retro response. my son is now 25, but when he was younger, I wouldn't allow him to have a Nintendo in the house. And so eventually he went and bought his own. And he wasn't allowed to watch TV until homework was done. And when I came home one day and he was watching TV and the homework wasn't done, I said, okay, turn it off. And it was about policing constantly, right? And so he turned to me and he said, so how high do my grades have to be able to do this? And so he was an A student, and I said, okay, if your grades go down, then there's no TV. And it's the grades stayed up. He graduated first in his class. He's a very smart kid. And he learned to manage his own TV time and Nintendo time and also play with his own friends and go out and do things with them. And I think we need to give them some control about doing what they're doing so they learn how to control their own excesses. And it's about an outcome measure, which are your school grades. So to have parents say, okay, your grades are now X, and if they go down, then this would get taken away, then they learn to manage it themselves.
Well, Clara, that might be very retro, but it seems also really smart to me as well. Let me give Dwight Garner a chance to weigh in on that. Make sense to you?
Oh, that's a very inspiring story.
There's hope, you know, right?
We try to do the same things, you know, but it's hard. We'll come in and say no TV until your homework is done, and the kids will say, well, our homework is done. And sometimes you don't find out that maybe it wasn't done or wasn't done as well as it might have been for a long time until the report card comes. You know, and we do crack down. As I said earlier, we've taken screens away and limited things. But in the long run, it's hard to keep to these rules. And I admit my failings here as a parent. I don't like playing the bad cop, and I do when I have to. But it's wearying. Mm-hmm.
Well, and what's interesting in the story, and Clara, thanks for the call to Radio Times, is that and her kid sounds like he was one in his class, so he's obviously a smart kid. that he did fine. But the idea is. Children and then adults have to figure out how to manage this stuff themselves. I mean, you're not going to have when you're 40, your parents telling you how to manage your social media.
Right. I think that's exactly right. I think they need to learn how to behave and interact with media. And I think rules are great in theory, and in practice, sometimes they don't work so well.
Yeah.
And you have challenges, especially with adolescents. Maybe with the younger kids, the rules come about more naturally and are easier to enforce. But I think with adolescents, it's a different ballgame, and it really depends on a lot of different factors.
Dwight, I remember doing an interview years ago about someone who wrote a book about the history of the telephone. And this always stayed with me, because when you read about the history of the telephone, it was going to destroy the family. No one was going to be able to have dinner together because the phone would be ringing. And it seems that we greet all these new technologies with a lot of hand-wringing. And then over time, we learn to live with them, sometimes for better or for worse.
We do. I mean, the telephone was going to destroy literacy as well. I mean,
exactly.
For people who wrote literary biographies, letters essentially ended when the telephone came along. And so for people writing biographies, that's the arrival of the telephone is when good correspondence ended. So that was just bad for writers. But I know it. But who can imagine what's coming next? I mean, it's kind of terrifying to think about, isn't it?
Well, we're just going to be completely wired in with, wires coming out of our heads, I think.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Clara. Let's see what Ron from the Northeast has to say. Hi, Ron. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I have four children from the ages of 7 to 15, and we heavily manage their screen, whether it's mobile or TV, and so that, as the last caller said, so that they can learn how to regulate themselves. But there's a couple concerns, because I also do workshops for teens on social media for youth workers and teenagers. And one of the things that I related to is I was in South Korea, and they have a real gaming addiction problem over there. And it's a result of these cafes they have, and students go there, and they'll play all night. And even though that may be a little different from phones, my concern is that with a phone, kids could disappear somewhere, and because it can be linked to the Internet, we have no idea who they're talking to or who may be talking to them, whereas with a regular phone, you know, when I was a kid, if I was talking to someone on the phone, my mom might pick up the phone and listen in.
That's right.
And so there's a certain kind of autonomy that happens, and part of my concern is that kids aren't being taught how to regulate it. So my kids go outside, their friends will come and say, can you come out and play? And they'll come out, and their friends are on their phones. And so my 15-year-old son figured out something. He said every time he takes a ball outside. When he takes a ball outside, it seems to change the whole focus of it. So I do still get concerned about the social aspect of it. I mean, there are ways where it may self-correct, but part of it is that how do you regulate something that they have endless access to a world that you might not know they're in, and others can have access to them?
Well, Ron, I think you encapsulated exactly what we've been talking about, and in many ways what you wrote about in the New York Times about how to manage and live with all these screens and all the access that the kids have to a world outside of our control.
We do, and then, you know, you worry about things that you don't know what your kids are stumbling upon on the Internet, you know, and I'm thinking particularly about pornography in terms of both my son and my daughter, who, you know, were 14 and 15. You know, God knows what they just stumble upon, what their friends show them. The wider world is more available to our children than it used to be, and we used to choose when to introduce our kids to certain things, and now those things come and find them, or they can so easily find them themselves, when maybe they're not quite ready for them yet.
I'm also thinking, Amy, about privacy settings. I mean, there are sort of technological fixes, I think. I mean, sometimes kids can figure out a way around them,
sure.
But especially when they're little, that
there are
gives parents some control.
Yeah, I'm sorry. There are some tools for parents, and a lot of parents that we surveyed too. Actually, when it comes to the internet, monitor their kids' internet and track them online. They may or may not be telling their adolescents this. But that's something they can do. And I think that's where parent concern is the highest from what we see, with especially with teenagers, as Dwight was saying, with access to pornography or online predators or online bullying even is a major concern now.
Yeah.
But when it comes to other media, the concern about what their kids are seeing isn't quite as high as with internet issues.
Have you thought, Dwight, about tracking your kids online? Their online, if you're concerned about it, their online interactions?
We do. We do look at our kids' computer histories on occasion. When we feel like they may have been untruthful with us about what they were doing all day on their computers, we have done that. I have very mixed feelings about that. When I was a teenager, you know, I really resented parents looking at things like letters of mine or journals or diaries. And I, you know, I like to give my children, you know, a sense that they have some privacy and personal space. Having said that, there are times when I will indeed check their computer histories.
Yeah, I mean, parents as the NSA and in a certain kind of way, you know, tracking behavior. Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Ron, thanks for the call. We're talking about screen time, living with all these screens and managing and navigating and negotiating them as well. 1-888-477-WHYY. We have Melora calling us from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was calling in because my husband and I run a nonprofit organization called Noise Ivy, and we teach tech education to kids from kindergarten all the way up through 12th grade. And what we find really interesting is that because kids have this innate attraction to technology, that it's easy and almost essential, I feel, that we take that and we turn them from being just the consumers, which is what I think we're all so concerned about, into producers of their own technology experience, where we're teaching them how to write code, how to make the video games, how to make their own websites. Because, I mean, if you look at it from a workforce development, their interest in technology is really kind of crucial for the development of our economy as it goes forward.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I mean, the idea is here are all these tools. And in many ways, Amy, kids are doing this anyway. I mean, they're making their own videos. And they are.
Blogging online. I mean, think of YouTube, all the user-generated content on YouTube. And every time the kids, you know, take their own pictures or their own videos, they're generating their own media, their own content.
Dwayne, I mean, do we see sort of a workforce under construction here?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, my son is interested in learning how to code, and he's done some coding online. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that interest doesn't compare to the interest he feels in immersing himself in a game. I mean, you know, coding is as much fun.
You one of the books you reviewed had to do with, it was written by someone named Pang, and he talked about something called mindful tweeting. And Dwight said, you said you're kind of an obsessive tweeter. What's mindful tweeting?
I don't know what mindful tweeting is, but his definition of it was, you know, knowing why you're online, thinking about why you're here to write a tweet, which to me is kind of absurd because Twitter is a social talky medium, and you know, I said the people who tweet mindfully are the people you don't want to follow at all. Because, but part of the joy—it's part of the joy of Twitter—is the joy of what we're doing right here, right now. It's off the cuff, it's commentary, it's alive. And to overthink Twitter is to sort of kill Twitter.
Let me see what. Thanks for calling in, Malora. Let's see what Erica has to say. Yes, Erica, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. I'm calling. I have three children, ages 16, 15, and 12. The two younger ones are boys and are much more enamored with games on their, you know, iPads and video games. Interestingly enough, my 16-year-old daughter is not so into that as much as she is reading on her Kindle. And I just wanted to throw out there that something that used to be as innocuous as reading when we were children has become yet another thing that I feel like I need to monitor, because while I can see all the books that she's downloading, the quality of what she's reading is something that we continually argue about. And she kind of has license. It's very hard to put these controls on the Kindle, so they download a lot of reading that I just don't think is really as good as what she could be reading.
Well, I'm curious, Erica, and then I'll toss it to our book reviewer, but what don't you want her to be reading that you found her reading on her Kindle?
Typical sort of teen lit novels, romance novels, maybe they get maybe a little bit too mature in certain areas. And, you know, I guess I'm sure my mom struggled with it with me when I was a teen, too, over the great numbers of good books that are out there that she would probably be interested in reading if she gave it a try. But it's that constant combativeness that you have with your teens over, you know, what you feel they should be reading versus what they want to be reading.
What do you think?
Kindle makes it so easy to download book after book after book, and, you know, again, it's that weary monitoring process of yet another thing, another device that I have to, you know, constantly be aware of.
Yeah, Erica, let me give Dwight Garner a chance to weigh in. Go ahead, Dwight.
I was just going to say, I think you should be overjoyed. I mean, that's how kids get the reading bug and learn how to read. You've got to let them read the stuff they want to read. I mean, I became a reader thanks to horror novels and genre stuff and Stephen King and shoot 'em ups. And it, you know, it's a phase you have to pass through. You have to get that gene that you just love to read and love narrative and love to be on the page. And I think as your child gets older, she'll find better books because you want better things as you get older and as your tastes improve. Mm. The fact that she's addicted to these things, I think, is probably a really good thing.
Because we're talking about reading, right?
I think so. And you know, I'm sure there are people who may never grow out of their young taste, but most of us do. And I think this could lead to her, you know, possibly becoming a serious reader.
What do you think, Amy?
I think that sounds right. I think any reading should be encouraged. The only thing we worry about from, or we're starting to look at, is the use of these tablets and devices right before bed. You know, a lot of us like to curl up with a good book in bed. But now with the screens, we worry that it could affect sleep.
Really? Because of the light?
Keep you awake. Yeah, the light.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Let me get one more caller in. Looks like we have Susan calling us from Collingswood, New Jersey. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. First off, I wanted to say I don't have any children to manage screen time, but I am a college professor at the University of Delaware, and my two points, and I'm curious as to what your guests have to say about this. When I teach, and I've been teaching for over 10 years, I've noticed all the students come in and sit and stare at their phones in the time before class starts. Nobody ever looks up to see the other people, and every once in a while I'll say, everybody put your phone down and start talking to each other. And they all do, and you hear laughter and conversation, and it's like you have to remind them to be social. So I'm curious as to what the long-term implications are for social interaction and interaction in the workplace in particular, because are these folks going to be, I don't know, less capable of working with other folks to, you know, get tasks done in a traditional sense? So I don't know what kind of, you know, considerations there are for the future on that.
Well, Susan, thanks for the call to Radio Time. She teaches at the University of Delaware. You teach at Penn?
Yeah, I mean, I see similar issues. I think with the phones, they're still socializing, just maybe not with each other in person. They're just socializing with other people at the time. I think what I have found in my classes is the use of laptops now, and they're open all the time. And a lot of kids say they take notes and they want to look along with the slides, but some of the times I can see what they're doing and they're on Facebook and they're not. And, you know, it's finding that balance between letting them use this technology and these devices as a tool for learning versus them just not paying attention and doing other things.
Or doing it
so
all.
So that's where I
once.
Find my, right. you know, challenge.
What about for you, Dwight?
Yeah, I worry about it. For example, I like to go into restaurants and when I'm by myself in a strange city, I'll often go to a restaurant and have dinner by myself, you know, at the bar of a restaurant. And in the old days, I might have, you know, striking up a conversation with someone. Now I'm there with my phone reading the news, and the person next to me is probably on their phone too. And I'm just aware that it shuts us off from certain things.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, both of you, for joining us today in Radio Times. Dwight Garner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And he's a book critic for the New York Times. And Amy Blakely, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And she's senior research scientist in health communication at the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, we use social media here at Radio Times. You can check us out. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, Facebook, Twitter, email, podcast, archive. It's all there. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.